Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, Episode 54, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. Why it's important to teach students about how their brain develops, what other countries can teach the United States about teacher professional development, and a graduating high schooler exemplifies the definition of determination. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, the first part of an amazing two-part interview with Hamish Brewer, the relentless principal that's disrupting the norms of school leadership with unlimited field trips and skateboard giveaways, and he's getting results. Hello, everybody. Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Guys, we got the band back together.
That's right.
It's been a couple episodes, right? I mean,
yeah,
it has been. Yeah, and a lot of that's my fault. So I've been really busy with work and just life in general.
In your defense. I'll be honest, we recorded two episodes on one day because I was doing some traveling and you couldn't make the day that we had to record two episodes. So, I mean, that's not really your fault. You know, I mean, that's one episode you would have typically missed, but instead you ended up missing two. So we're all back together. We're glad to be here. Has everyone had a good start to their summer? It's not over yet, is it? Like, we're still just kind of getting started.
I mean, my life is definitely the most boring of the three of us. I've been just going through the motions.
Yeah.
Another day, another dollar.
Starting at a new school, right?
I am in August. Yes.
That's good.
So, yeah,
that's good. Congrats.
Getting my classroom ready.
Yeah.
Like getting that first, you know, day whenever everything's fresh and new and it smells like pencils and erasers. Like, you know, you get to have that again. You know what I mean? Like, you're starting at someplace new. You know, it's like a fresh, totally fresh start. That's exciting.
Yes, I'm very excited, but I'm also super nervous. You know, I mean, I'm so excited for a new school family. Like, I think sometimes people don't realize when they take a break from education, and not that I took a break, but I was not located at a school for this last calendar year. And for all the other years I have been. And so you miss the college, you miss, you have a family, there's a work support family. And so you don't realize, I think a lot of educators that retire, I think that's the thing they miss the most is the teachers next door and the laughs and the, you know, that's a family.
What anxiety do you have about starting?
One of the biggest anxieties I have is that everyone at this school, as far as teachers, they know who I am, and I don't know who they are. You know, I know some of them.
Well, no, it's the podcast. It's the podcast.
Sort of a big
that's,
deal.
Yeah, it's the podcast. Totally the podcast. No, they probably have no idea I do a podcast.
Well, maybe you can spread the word over there.
I will. I'll tell them.
That'd be great. Thanks, Lissa.
It's because of the things I do in the art community and things. So they do. They're so excited, and I have gotten a lot of wonderful, positive feedback on Facebook of people messaging me saying, "Hey, I teach at the school you're going to be at next year, and we're so excited to have you," which is wonderful, but I don't want to blow it. I mean, I want to be everything they think I am. I'm gonna paint my house to be a rainbow so that they're like, she just is wonderful, you know.
Right.
And so that is probably my biggest anxiety, is just getting used to a new, you know, a whole new way of doing things, because every school is different, and I've taught at several different schools.
Well, Lissa, what do you know? What's going down in the teacher's lounge?
Well, this is a great little short little article out of Edutopia about the importance and the benefits of teaching students about brain potential. And we've talked about this a little bit. We've had speakers that have spoken about this. But more importantly, that learning changes the actual structure of your brain. And if you can illustrate that to your classroom, mm-hmm. even in the younger classes, if you can show them how the brain physically changes and what that means and your control of that, mm-hmm. that you are the navigator of that, then it leads to more retention and just positive growth and motivation, mostly motivation.
Yeah.
So one of the examples that I loved, but probably because it has a little bit of an art base to it, is a teacher, Diane Dahl, out of Texas. She made a classroom brain, which, side note, I think brains are really gross to look at, but she made one out of pipe cleaners. And so basically, and Russ, you probably would know more of the science of this, but like the neurons and the dendrites and the axons and all those things that connect and, you know, spark new pathways of learning. So they were given three little pipe cleaners that they had to twist together. And as they learned things throughout the year, they would connect it, connect their neurons and dendrites. Am I saying?
You get like more pipe cleaners?
Yes. So they would connect everybody would connect their own little cluster to each other. And it started to build a circular mass.
Cool. So rather than handing out stars.
That's right. But then they took it further. They would put a sticky note of this is what I learned. Like one person maybe had learned about the Underground Railroad, which someone else may have recalled the lady's name, Harriet Tubman. And somebody else, you know, may have made the connection to something current. And so different sticky notes that go with what each. And so as the year grows, you have this growing circular mass of tangled pipe cleaners, and she suspends it from the ceiling to where the children can walk up to the brain, to the class brain, and read all the things that they have learned throughout the year. And as they learn, as they read new stories or things like that, they make connections to previous things and relate it in some way, and they'll add a sticky note to that or another pipe cleaner. And that is part of the thing, is it's really important to connect new material to old material.
And this is really how the brain works, right?
Right. So that's what's absolutely so cool about it. And so she's making the children take ownership of that. I remember a teacher that I had when I was in second grade, and she told us that we needed to understand that our brain was like a filing cabinet, a really large filing cabinet, and it's really important. And sometimes she would actively say, I need you to file this under such and such in your brain, or I need you to pull out the drawer that is under history, and I need you to find the Civil War, and I need you to put this in that folder. She would actively tell us that, and I've never forgotten it, and I feel like I do that. I feel like it as an adult that I do try to file things, and then so when something sparks my interest, there's several things that run up right behind it because they're in that same file folder in my brain.
Russ, I mean, why do you think it's important for students to know how the brain works?
Well, I think it affects them, you know, how they retain information. And they're in this, they're in the process of, you know, people kind of look at school as like filling of a vessel, you know, and that's not really what school is about. School is about, there are things that you want to know from like a rote memorization standpoint. But, you know, like you need to know, you know, 1776 and all that kind of stuff, right? But really, school is more about teaching people how to learn in the future and building, you know, foundational knowledge as well. So, you know, I think providing some, you know, examples of exactly how the brain is a neural network, right? And that's exactly what they're building. And so I was kind of smiling while Lissa was describing this because we work a lot, you know, you're hearing a lot about AI, you know, like Siri and Cortana and Alexa and all these other people that use, by the way, all of my Amazons just went off in my room, by the way, when I said that.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
I don't have those things.
Well, there you go. So, but those are all based on neural networks, right? And, you know, computers are trying to mimic the way humans learn. And so I think it's great that, you know, children are kind of learning the way a brain works because it affects how they, you know, the uptake of information, how they learn to do new things. And I don't know. I just think it's a fascinating way. And I was like, oh, pipe cleaners and whatever, when you first got into the story. But as we kind of progressed through it, I really thought that was very, very cool. I was impressed.
If you go back and you listen to two episodes ago, it was with Dr. Jo Bowler, and she is the Stanford education professor. She's a rock star in terms of math education. And that's what her whole mission is to, because people think they're not a math person, but her point is, no, you are. Anyone's a math person because your brain, you're wired. It's just a matter of connecting those wires.
That's right.
And I don't know. I feel like this kind of
piggybacks on
that.
And doing it in a way that speaks to you. I do think it's important for children, just like, okay, you take a teenager that gets a new car, okay? And not a new car. They may inherit their mom's, you know, Sentra or whatever that they never loved that car, but when it became their car, all of a sudden they're cleaning it, they're doing all, because it's their car, you know? So taking ownership and tending to what is theirs, even if it's something that's always been around. So I think when you let a child know, this is your brain, I feel like I'm about to say, like, this is your brain on drugs. This is, you know.
But, our 80s listeners
yes,
will know
exactly.
What you're talking about.
So,
I was about to say, we may be missing some of our demos.
Yeah,
so
right.
This is your brain, and this is how it works, and you can make it the most high-functioning brain you want to make it. But you're the one that owns this brain.
I'm on Twitter a lot, always kind of following educators and just, you know, what they're up to. And Twitter's such a great community for educators. But I noticed, like, right now, this time of year, it is like professional development time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's nothing but, like, people at conferences and sharing and speakers. And it's pretty interesting. And Russ, I think you've got a little something on professional development today, right?
I do, actually. It's actually talking about PISA, and I'm going to go into that a little bit. But essentially, it's an article that came out a few days ago in Education Week. And the title of the article is What Other Countries Can Teach the U.S. About Teacher Professional Development. And there is something called the Program for International Student Assessment, which is administered every couple of years in about 30 industrialized nations. And the U.S. doesn't typically perform incredibly well in this survey. In fact, if I were to, I'm going to read off very, very quickly the highest performing countries and economies according to PISA, Australia, and they break out different parts of China. So Beijing, Shanghai, China, Canada, England, Estonia, Finland, the Flemish community of Belgium, Germany, Hong Kong, which is part of China now, Japan, Korea, Macau, which is also part of China, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Singapore, Slovenia, Switzerland, and Chinese Taipei.
Did you skip us?
No, I did not skip you. We're just not in the highest performing countries. And so they were basically looking at this PISA survey, and they broke it down, and they're talking about what makes the U.S. different. Why are we not on top of this thing? We certainly spend more money than most. We certainly, we're a large industrialized country. One would think that the Flemish community of Belgium, which I did not know was the formal way to say that, would be lower than the U.S., but it isn't, right? So what are they doing that we're not? Let's say you're going back to the classroom after a year, elsewhere. You know, whenever you first started, did you feel like you had a good, quote, bridge of between theory and practice?
No, I didn't.
No one does. It's a trick question, right? I ask it all the time. Like, do you, I ask teachers all the time, the first time you tell it, did you feel prepared to teach? And they say, but it always ends in laughter.
No,
right?
Because we want to be positive, but how do you be positive when you're saying, no?
There are two other elements that really came into this PISA study that I wanted to bring up as well. One is a variety of opportunities for PD tailored at the individual teacher. So most schools in these 19 regions, teachers had access to in-house PD, and they were school-based workshops, right? They weren't the external ones like attending a lecture, going to a conference. It was peer learning, right? It was things that people had found that was interesting. And instead of having some consultant coming in at $1,200 a day or $1,800 a day or whatever they pay these guys these days, they had people inside the school saying, this is really interesting. Here's some things that I learned, and here's how I think you can apply them in their classroom. And I got to be honest with you, I know that some people are doing stuff like that, but most schools that I know of, and I'm not saying all, but most still consider PD to be like an external resource, that we don't have this knowledge, therefore someone has to come in and teach us this knowledge. And I think that this study kind of indicates that the people that can teach you a lot about teaching are right there in your school. They read, they learn, and they come back and they bring it back. And the third thing, and this is where it really hits home for me, is teacher evaluation practices that prioritize continuous improvement. So I'm going to say this, and it may step on some toes, right? But the teacher evaluation process in a large portion of the United States is a complete and total joke. Like, the whole process is broken, and folks have tried to adopt, like, Race to the Top really pushed people to adopt like the Danielson and Marzano models for continual improvement. And what we found after all this time is that folks are still largely completing evaluations just like they did 10 years ago. They just have a new, quote, rubric or a new instrument in order to do that. It's not actually minting teachers that are better teachers. And in fact, the Gates Foundation just went into this. So the Gates Foundation over the last few years, between 2008 and 2013, how much money do you think the Gates Foundation alone spent on teacher improvement for teacher evaluations? How much money do you guys think they spent?
$100 million.
I have no idea.
$700 million.
Wow.
$700 million. And you know what they found? Didn't make a bit of difference. Do you know why? Because the concepts were sound, but whenever they made it back down to the classroom, the administrators that were walking around, really there was, it looks to me that there wasn't a lot of buy-in, right? The performance was just mixed. And so they ended up, you know, giving people all fours or all fives. At the end of the day, you know, folks kind of tend to hover towards wanting a teacher evaluation process that ends in a rating, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, A, B, C, D, F, whatever the case is. I don't care. Pink, blue, green, orange, who cares, right? People kind of want things to sum up in a nice box. And what this article indicated was that that wasn't, these countries that did really well did not prioritize coming up with a summative evaluation as much as they came up with continuous improvement, prescribing ways to tweak your performance on a day-to-day basis to improve.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're saying don't score people, just give them a roadmap.
Yeah. And I think that like a lot of this has turned into scoring, but yeah, give them a roadmap on continuous improvement. Instead of saying you're a C and we'd really like to see you a B next year, that's all fine and good, but it should be focused around finding ways to get them to a B, right? If you're weak in you know, classroom management, then here are the resources and there's the follow through, right? Because it's a continual improvement process. It's not just here's your score and here's your prescription for the next year. We'll see you in 365 days, right? That's not what it is. It is, we are going to work with you to improve these skills in which you're weak.
Well, good stuff, Russ. Thank you for sharing that EdWeek article. Did you guys hear about Corey Patrick? Do y'all know? Does that name ring a bell? It's an Alabama student. He was, somebody snapped a picture of him headed to graduation in his cap and gown, and he was walking to the public bus stop to get to graduation. And so a radio DJ, I'm pretty sure he's syndicated, he's pretty big, Ricky Smiley, saw the picture, and he's like, who is this kid? Why is he walking to a bus stop to get to graduation in a cap and gown, like a public bus? Like, why is no one not driving them there? And so they kind of looked into his story. And turns out for the entire senior year that he had, his family had moved, but he was still going to the school that he had always been going to. Mm-hmm. But there was no way to get there, and his family didn't have a car. So for the entire year, he had been getting up at 4:30 in the morning, walking to a public bus stop, taking a 90-minute public transportation commute to his high school just so he could, you know, graduate at the school he had been going to. And then in the evening, he'd have to wait till like 5-something for the bus to come pick him up, and he would get home till like 7 o'clock at night. So this DJ, he went and, you know, rounded up a few friends, and they bought him a car for a graduation gift.
Oh, gosh, how wonderful.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. It was a really cool story. They had him on the radio show, and just, you know, he really is the example of determination. 90 minutes, you know, you anyone who's done a long commute to work, you know, you take that job or you move somewhere and you're like, oh, yeah, I can drive 90 minutes. I know, Russ, not to get personal, but I know your wife had a long commute for a while. And you yeah. think you think out the gate, you know, I can do this. But it starts to wear on you after
yes,
a while.
It does. And also there's a lot of children, especially at the high school level, that get themselves up for school, get themselves to school mm-hmm. with a parent not there because, you know, nobody, the first person to speak to them in the morning is the teacher or the other students that greet them at school. That happens a ton. Or the bus driver that drove them to school is probably the first person that
right.
greets them. You know, just because you go to a high school doesn't mean you have a car. And that's wonderful that, you know, we can provide public transportation. But I do want to know, were his parents boarding the bus with him too? Did they go to his graduation?
The family did get to graduation, but they used different transportation. I guess he had to be there earlier.
He had to be there early. Okay,
yeah,
that
and
makes
they said that they did get okay. there for the graduation. But again, still, and I think that's what caught the DJ's attention was mm-hmm. like,
wait a minute, yeah.
Yeah, why is his family not taking him to graduation mm-hmm. or why is he not driving? He's 19 years old.
what a great story, though, about this kid who persevered. He got up at 4:30 awesome. In the morning.
Yeah.
Listen to me. I love my job, but if I had to get up every day at 4:30 in order to do it, I don't know if I would be doing that job in 5 years. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think it's fantastic. Good find.
Yeah. So anyhow, are you guys ready for the bright idea?
Let's hear it.
We've got a guy who is known as the relentless educator.
We are not here to be average. We're here to be amazing. Does everybody understand?
Yes, sir! And he is a principal up in the Northern Virginia area. He appears to be somewhat of a fixer of schools, and he's got an energy that is just infectious.
Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is a school principal in Northern Virginia, but he's anything but your typical principal. Hamish Brewer is known as the relentless principal, and he also has a reputation as an educational disruptor, a motivator, and a fixer of schools in need, and he's here to tell us how he does it. Hamish, welcome to the show.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You know, I first discovered you on Twitter, and then I kind of dug a little deeper, and I found a video on YouTube, and it was produced by Freethink.
You know, in education, we got a huge problem. You've got to move away from this archaic educational process where we build these schools on square boxes and kids fill these square boxes. The world isn't a square box no more. Time's changed. Kids have changed, and we got to move with that. How far are you willing to go for a child?
And the quality of the video and the quality of the work that you're doing is incredible. So I'm going to link it to the show notes so anyone can see it. But the video tells the story of your time in Northern Virginia. You were teaching at Occoquan Elementary, and it talks about all the changes you made there. And then it kind of goes into the transition of your time going to another elementary, Fred Lynn Elementary, which I believe you are now, right?
Yeah, Fred Lynn Middle School. So I went from elementary to the middle school, but my elementary feeds into there.
What I want to do in this interview is first just kind of talk about your style and how you change things over at Occoquan. So when you first became principal at Occoquan, what was the environment like there?
Yeah, you know, Occoquan was a sleepy little school. It had just transitioned with the new state. The state changed their exams and things like that, and scores weren't where we wanted them to be. It was a school in transition a little bit, you know, coming off a principal and then coming to me as principal. It's a school that is high poverty, has a lot of very diverse population, second language population, and, you know, just that's kind of where we were. It's one of the oldest elementaries in that school division. The building was almost 100 years old. It was pretty cool. You know, underneath there was World War II bunkers. How about that? Big concrete bunkers.
And so you came in, and I guess you probably had a vision and a mission that you wanted to implement there. And you kind of did some pretty, I won't call them drastic, but I think some people might, things. And I'm going to kind of go through a list, and you feel free to throw in any other things that you may have done. But you started unlimited field trips at the school. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, I thought, you know, one of my goals is to make education and instruction authentic, relevant, and real, you know, like bring education alive, bring it out of textbooks and worksheets. You know, I'm a dead against textbooks and worksheets. I think we fall into the trap of that, and teaching to an exam, I'm just dead against those things. You know, I think teaching to an exam has definitely watered down, has dumbed down the instruction of teachers because we're teaching to an exam, you know. So I wanted to see what can we do to make learning more authentic? What can we do to bring teaching alive for the teachers and alive in the classroom for the students? Now, I'm in a pretty good spot. We're in Northern Virginia. We're about 30 miles outside of DC, and there's lots around us to see and do. I'm like, why are we not there? It's all right there, you know. And then as you start to talk to more schools, they have the same thing, you know, lots of amazing opportunities around them, and we weren't taking advantage of it. And so I said, let's do it. And it actually started with a conversation with some of my kindergarten teachers. We were talking about how so many of our students had not been into Washington, D.C., into the nation's capital, and we were right there, you know, like we're in the metropolitan area, in the neighborhood, and we hadn't been there. I said, well, let's take them on a field trip right there. Let's take them and put them on location, and let's make that happen. And that unleashed from there conversation in our school. And I said to everybody, I said, why don't we go on unlimited field trips. If there's an opportunity for you to bring your content alive and you can be on location or in the real environment, let's do it. And so the teachers got behind, I got behind it, and it was the parents loved it, the students loved it. And it was a really huge, you know, when you can make the learning real and authentic like that, kids don't forget that, you know, kids don't forget those magical opportunities they have. And we're about creating those opportunities and magical moments every day. And that was included in our unlimited field trip scheme. And we went everywhere. And so much of it's free. You know, even if it's a park, even if it's an estuary, you know, you're learning science and you're learning about waterways. It's free to go to those. So why don't we go there and actually do something on location?
Some other things you did, maybe not as obvious. You changed light bulbs?
Yeah, you know, so I think it's really important. You know, we're still building schools today based on this format from, you know, years and years ago. You know, not much has changed. If anything's changed, we're just adding more glass, more light. It's still the same square box. And I get so frustrated that our kids are living in a square box because that's not their world anymore. The world is not a square box, you know. And so I wanted to appeal to the senses. I'm like, I believe if we can appeal to the senses of look, feel, touch, smell, great things can happen. And so we had a really stark environment. You know, it was plain. There wasn't much happening. I was like, man, we got to bring this alive. And you walk down so many corridors in schools today, and the hallways and corridors are under a yellow light, and it's so dull, it's boring, you don't feel good, it's like a rainy day. And I was like, we got to bring the sunshine out in our school. And so I changed to investigated daylight bulbs and what we had to do around that. And then two schools, I think I've come close to changing out close to 16,000 light bulbs when it's all said and done.
I got to ask then, I got to cut you off. You changed 16,000 light bulbs. How do you justify that bill to your superintendent? You know, like how did you sell that to them?
Well, I think you can, there's a couple of ways to do that, right? You can phase that in over time. Every time you change a light bulb, you replace it with a daylight bulb. That's one way to do it. I saw it as having instructional value. I saw it as having impact on our learning environment, on our student engagement, and the health and well-being of our staff and students. And so when we did that, you know, there is some research out there that does support people being under a certain light bulb, under a certain light, being healthier, more vibrant, more engaged. So it wasn't just, hey, I'm going to change the light bulbs out today. I actually thought it through. I looked at even down to the point where do the ballasts that hold the light bulb, are they conducive to being able to have a daylight bulb? You got to check that out as well. And so, you know, one of the nice things is we're site-based where I am. And so there's an opportunity to make some decisions like that. And I felt good about it. I felt like it was the direction we need. I wanted to change the game, you know, because what we was doing was not working. And all too often in education, everybody continues to do something that's not working. Often we might identify something and then we do nothing about it. I'm saying, let's do something about it. We're not going to sit stagnant. You know, education is so reactionary. It's so archaic, our practices. Like, we should be on the front end. We should be on the front end of innovation and ideas and free thinking like that where you can explore. And so that's where I went. I just decided one day that I was like, man, we need to appeal to the senses more. So we went with the daylight bulbs and the audio enhanced classrooms.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to engage our kids in their instructional process more and reach children more. And so I started investigating sound, and you start seeing that, you know, it's like when you listen to music and you can hear it through a good quality speaker, it changes how you feel and the emotion that you have in that experience. And I was like, well, can we translate that to the classroom? And so I did some investigation about that. And, you know, you've got different office spaces or meeting rooms that have great sound. And I was like, why can't that be like the classroom? And the more I investigate, the more I started to see that, you know, children tune into pitch. Children find different pitches and different wavelengths themselves that they tune into. And so we found I investigated a number of speakers, and I found a speaker that worked for us that provided 360-degree sound for the kids, and that it would broadcast and amplify the teacher's voice through the microphone and out to the kids, and they can actually record and download their session online. So that's something we started exploring. But as we started doing more of it, you know, you can mute it, you can go from small group to whole group, and it catches the attention of the kids really quick. The students loved it. The teachers loved it. Probably one of the single most exciting things I implemented was this. I was going to start with the upper grades, and then I tried it down in the kindergarten, and then before long, every single teacher wanted it. And because it changed the instructional game, it got kids' attention. Kids were replying to teacher instruction faster, teacher direction faster. Kids were engaged in their groups. Instructions were being given out a whole lot better. Teachers were healthier. They weren't going home with sore throats, going home sick, all those sorts of things. So the impact was amazing. It also worked twofold because it improved our technology in our classrooms. All of a sudden, our sound off our boards, our smart boards or Prothean, whatever you use, it projected the video off the boards a whole lot better, produced music for our dance parties and dancing in the classrooms and brain breaks and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it was just game changing when you start adding all these components together, like, for instance, double recesses. Like, why? We stopped having kids go outside and play. You know, I work with a lot of second language learners, and the research supports it too. Like, our kids should be communicating and in dialogue. And so we included that in the concept. And when you started putting all these things together, unlimited field trips, audio enhanced classrooms, deskless school, all these different things, it started to bring the classroom, the school alive. It changed the landscape and then learning environment completely 180 degrees.
And we should say, for anyone who's wondering, you won awards when you were with the school.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, we accomplished some really amazing things, and we did some stuff that very few people get the opportunity to say they were able to do. We become a nationally distinguished Title I school, the very first in our school division, and we won in Category 3, which was basically for the minimum requirement is great academic results, great environment, and all that kind of stuff. And we won in Category 3 for special populations, special education, ESOL, migrant, homeless, all that kind of thing. And only 6 schools in the nation won last year in the year that we won. So we became a nationally distinguished Title I school. We rallied around. The culture in our school was like something special. I relate it to, you know, you put together that championship team and you go on that run. We went on a magical run together. We were all in. We had a gang mentality for each other. Like, where one goes, we all go. We got each other's back. We support each other. You know, when you need some help, who do you turn to? When you look over your shoulder, who's standing there? And we say every single one of us. You know, we started changing the game about how we talk in our school, the vocabulary of our school. Like, for instance, do you call your school a fortress? Like, we called our school a fortress. We were creating a fortress. Who says that, right? Who refers to their staff as gang? Like, we're coming for everybody. And we all and we started changing our emotion and our strategy for how we go about our work. We were like, we went from being like on the back foot to the front foot. You know, defense became our offense. And we started telling everybody, we want to be the number one ranked school. We want to be a model for everybody to see. And the teachers loved it. They loved having the green light, the opportunity to be the best and most amazing teacher they can be. Like, all too often in education, we're too scared to tell someone, go out and be the best teacher on the planet. Oh, but don't have a competition. It's not a competition, but don't upset this person or that person. That's not true, man. That's not how it rolls. Like, we should want every single teacher in our building striving to be the very best teacher on the planet, because that's what we want for kids. It's like this whole concept of, oh, I'm going to tell you right now, kids in my building are not a label. We stopped defining our kids as a label. They weren't special education. They weren't ESOL. They weren't gifted. They were all our kids. You don't hide good instruction for certain kids. You bring out the best instruction for everybody, because every kid deserves it. And we started making it about family, man. I have this saying, we enroll families. We don't enroll students. And when you start having this different thought process about your community and things you're doing, leaving a legacy, we put to work, our work became a legacy. We defined our work and our inspiration for changing communities and changing outcomes of school. And we wanted to leave a legacy of greatness, and we wanted to be relentless. And then it started becoming what was happening on our walls. Like, you know, people like, oh, you got these cool murals and that. Yeah, but that's not what it's about. It's not about the mural. It's about what it means. Your school is the expectation you set for it. Your school is the expectation. It becomes the expectation of the things, the vocabulary, the language, the visuals, the things kids get to see each and every day. That becomes the expectation of your school.
You know,
rolling now, bro.
Exactly. And I think that passion that our listeners are hearing right now is something that your teachers and your students hear. And that's a little bit of the X factor. Anyone can go in and do unlimited field trips and change light bulbs and enhance the classroom. But there's this X factor. You're loud.
I brought you all in here because I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. There's people that talk about you that don't even know you. You know what they say? There's lots of fights. There's lots of trouble. Well, we're going to change that.
You're like a football coach. You get up in front of your gymnasium or your cafeteria. You'll stand on a cafeteria table, and you speak with that passion to the students. Why is it important for you to do that?
You know, because as a kid growing up, I struggled mightily at school. School was tough for me. You know, I failed miserably at high school, failed exams, the whole nine yards. And, you know, I heard things said about me, or what teachers said about me, or said to my parent at the time, you know, that you're not going to amount to anything. You're not smart enough for this. You can't do this, you know? Like, who has the right to do that? I remember being in architecture class, like they call it engineering now, or technical drawing. And I wasn't able to stay in the class because I couldn't keep my sheet of paper clean because I kept smudging the lines. That teacher didn't know. Maybe I was a genius technical drawer that was going to be architecture beauty. I never got to see that future because I got kicked out of the class. I'm not allowed to take it because I kept smudging the paper. And I said, no child is ever going to hear those things in my school. And when you make it personal like that, like I was one of these kids. I grew up around many of the things that my kids grew up around, too much drugs and alcohol, domestic violence. My parents were separated. So I know what it's like to be on that end. And I tell my kids each and every day, life ain't going to give you a handout. Like, we got to stop sissifying the education system. We've got to a point where we've sissified it. And we went away from that. We said, we're not going to give our kids a handout. We're going to make our kids earn everything. And that the harder they work, the more they get. And we're going to teach them the right characters about being a good person and getting after it, because life don't give you a handout. You know, when you get out there, they're not going to give you a hug because you did a bad job. You know, you've got to have the skill set to be able to rebound from that, to unpack what you did so that you can move forward. It's how you dust yourself off, get back up and go again. And so, like, we have the one more round philosophy with the boxing ring. Who puts a boxing ring up in their school? I've done it in multiple locations now, had the boxing ring, one more round. And what it stands for, it's not about boxing. It's about the fight. It's about the not quitting. We can't quit. We can't be beat. You're not going to beat me. You're going to knock me down, but I'm going to get back up again. And so we taught our kids the expectation to be relentless, to not quit, to not give up. It's like we have another saying. I have this other saying called chasing 100. I don't tell everybody we're going to get 100 because that's just a pipe dream. That's false. You can't sell that to a child or to a parent or to a community. So we sell we're chasing 100 because there's a difference. You give me effort and you give me your best each and every day, things are going to take care of themselves. And we're going to get closer to 100 that way. I want you to give me everything you got today, and that's where we'll stand. It's like exams. Everybody's like, teaching to exams today, that's got to stop, man. What matters is what you do each and every day. I tell my staff, if we're bringing it and we're on fire each and every day, great things are going to happen. We don't have to worry about exams. We had the highest exam results in our school division. Like, we had scores in the high 90s for everything. And we were a Title I school. Like, who says you can do that? I say we can. Because kids are not a label. Poverty is not a learning disability. And we're not going to quit on our kids. And so we had this mindset, this aggressive nature. And I'm in the face of my teachers and students and willing them on, inspiring them on that we can be great. Nobody's going to hold us back. Woo!
You high-five kids as you walk through the hallway.
Down low, down low, down low. Up high, up high. Let's go.
Give a morning announcement, and you have that same energy that you have right now on the morning announcement, but you said something that stood out to me. You said,
if somebody didn't tell you today they love you, Mr. Brewer is telling you today that he loves you. Have a great day.
Yeah, there's not enough love in the world, man. We forgot to tell kids we love them. We stopped using that word love, you know? And so many of our kids don't hear that word enough. And it doesn't matter if you're from a affluent school, poor school, middle school, high school, elementary school. It doesn't matter where you go. Kids still need to be loved and hear that they love them, you know? Kids are kids at heart. And so when even at the middle school, the kids are, they're like, if I'm not on the announcements that day and say that, they know. And they're coming up and they're finding, Mr. Brewer, you didn't say you loved us today. And so you know it matters to them if they're chasing this down. And I tell the kids in the car all the time, I love you. Or if they're in some hot water with me, I don't like what you did, but I still love you. I love you, but I don't like what you did, you know? And so when you build a philosophy, if you build a culture and expectation around love, hard conversations can be had. It's real. It's authentic, and it's not fake. And kids see through fakeness all the time. But I hug my kids. I tell them I love them every day, and they have my back.
You skateboard through the hallways. You give away skateboards. Yeah. I mean, is skateboarding just a passion of yours?
Yeah. Since I was young, I've always been an extreme sports guy. I've loved those things. I've rock climbed through Southeast Asia. I was an adrenaline junkie, but I love skateboarding and skateboard has always been there, you know, and things like skateboarding and soccer, for instance, you can do it anywhere in the world at any time. And you don't need a whole lot to accomplish it. But the skateboarding for me is I'm not the world's best skateboarder by no means. I love getting on my longboard and cruising. And the school hallways are so much fun for that. So much fun for that. And the kids just love it. And think about this, man. When we were at school and we were young, everybody was saying those skateboarders are bad guys, bad dudes. You know, don't hang out with the skateboarders. Oh, they're trouble. Well, they're not. And part of it is this, dude. Every single child deserves a voice. Every single child deserves a place in our school. We shouldn't be picking and choosing what's right and wrong or what a kid's interests are. If you're into skateboarding, run with it. Love it. Go for it. You know, like, who are we to say it's not okay for you to skateboard? That we're going to assume that because you're skateboarding, you're bad news. Like, there was this whole concept around that. And so I'm trying to break that barrier down and say that every kid matters. Every child deserves a voice. It's like my anti-bullying campaign, dude. I'm on an anti-bullying tirade right now, dude. I teamed up with Fear the Fighter. It's an MMA fight t-shirt company. And they do a lot of t-shirts for MMA fighters and stuff. And it's gone global, dude. Everybody's buying these t-shirts and they're like putting their own mascots on it because we're hitting bullying head on. We're not talking about it. We're not trying to dream up another program about it. We're saying it's unacceptable. We're going to do something about it. We're not going to tolerate it. And every person deserves to be themselves and have their space to express themselves and be who they want to be at any time of the day. And our kids and our staff have got behind it like crazy. Our kids love it. And we made it cool to not bully. Like, our kids won't tolerate it. You know, they're not going to put up with it. And this is at a middle school, you know, one of the toughest in the state of Virginia. And so we're turning that around.
How do you sell all this unique and this disruptive education style up? How do you sell it to your superintendent? Did you have to, you know, really get in there and be like, just trust me, I'm going to do this? Or did they see the results up front?
Well, I think it's a combination of everything, right? I'm not going half in. Like, I'm not like half in on this. I'm all in. I'm passionate about it. It's meaningful. And yeah, I'm getting results as well. And I'm turning around communities. I mean, I'm turning around some of the toughest communities in the country, you know, and getting results. So I'm doing something that's working. And it's not rocket science. I'm trying to show people that if we stop overcomplicating the education system, we're going to have far more success. What we do is we reinvent the wheel way too much. Educators are the best in the world at reinventing the wheel, reinventing the curriculum. I tell teachers all the time, the curriculum's been written. Don't rewrite it, just teach it. Like, it's simple, teaching's simple. What do we have to teach? How are we going to teach it? How do we know they learned it? And if they didn't, what are we going to do? But we turn education into a Pinterest board and make it incredibly difficult. And when we do that, we lose focus. We lose sight of the target, you know? And so I'm saying, look, unlimited field trips, painting up your hallways, putting some good light in there, teaching on fire, being deskless. None of this is rocket science. It's just having the courage. Leadership takes courage, man. There's a lot of courage in leadership. And I've learned this from my travels around the world. And everybody wants to know about Relentless. And everybody's like loving Relentless. And everybody's all about it. Everybody has their own versions of Relentless. I'm not that far detached. Like, it's having the courage, the will, the desire, and the passion to do these things. Like, everybody's like, how do you keep turning schools around? How do you keep making these improvements? I said, because it's culture, it's relationships. I listen and I simplify it. You know what the biggest problem with school improvement is? Everybody keeps adding to schools. Do this, do this, do this, do this program, do this program. Programs don't fix kids. Great teaching fix kids. It's like reading. Everybody wants to know, how'd you get your reading results? Because I had kids reading. Like, think about this. How many minutes in a day does a kid truly read? When you start adding it up, it's not a whole lot. And so I said, let's have our kids reading and writing all day long. And so we increased that. Our kids were reading and writing all day long through authentic text. Like, you can't beat putting a book in the hands of a kid. Yet we're trying to overcomplicate it with 10 other things.
If somebody wants to keep up with you, follow you, where do they find you? On Twitter, website?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at BrewerHM. You can find me at my Facebook website, Relentless Learning, and I'm on Instagram as the Relentless Principal.
All right, so here's what I want to do. We've been talking a lot about your style and what you did at Occoquan. I want to talk a little bit more, but we're going to save it for the next show. And I want to hear about your transition to Fred Lynn. You went to another elementary school. I want to hear all about that. So be sure to tune in next week, and we're going to continue to talk with Principal Brewer about his unique style and really what it takes to implement it in your school. That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.